In parts of Iowa in recent years, shootings have flared up. This hour, a conversation on violence in Iowa. It's a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. What happens when gun violence and violence in general are viewed not only as a matter of law enforcement, but also as a public health issue? This hour, a recent panel discussion I led on this question that included Dr. Lena Wen, Health Commissioner for the City of Baltimore. Also, Carletta Knox Seymour of Iowans for Gun Safety, Corinne Peek Asa of the University of Iowa Injury Prevention Research Center, and Benny LeHue of the Iowa Department of Public Health. A community conversation on violence in Iowa. First, this hour's news. The past few years have seen spikes in gun violence in certain parts of Iowa, in Cedar Rapids and in Des Moines in particular. And this hour, we want to examine how the state of Iowa is dealing with violence as a public health issue. I'm Ben Kiefer, and this is a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's a community conversation on violence in Iowa, recorded Tuesday, April 18th, 2017, at Callahan Auditorium at the University of Iowa College of Public Health. And we are so glad at Iowa Public Radio to be invited to partner with the College of Public Health here at the University of Iowa. Joining us this hour, Dr. Lena Wen, Health Commissioner for the City of Baltimore, has been in that position since January of 2015. She has a long resume. Some of the top items, she's of course an ER physician as well, and author of When Doctors Don't Listen. Also founder of Who's My Doctor? That's a project to encourage transparency in medicine. And she is also the recipient of the University of Iowa College of Public Health Hansen Award for Public Health Leadership. Joining her on the panel as well, Carletta Knox Seymour is the president of the Board of Iowans for Gun Safety. Next to her, Corinne Peek Asa, Associate Dean for Research at the University of Iowa College of Public Health, also Director of the University of Iowa Injury Prevention Research Center. And finally, at the end of our table, on our panel, Benny LeHue, Coordinator for Injury and Violence Prevention at the Iowa Department of Public Health. Let's welcome our panelists. Dr. Wen, let's start with you as the honored guest on the campus over the next couple of days here at the University of Iowa. Health Commissioner for the City of Baltimore, you have traveled around the world listening to patient stories, I understand. You were born in Shanghai, though you grew up in Los Angeles. You're a Rhodes Scholar, and you've done many other things. Let's skip right to your start in Baltimore in January of 2015. Tell us a little bit about Baltimore's recent history of violence, gun violence. When you stepped into the picture, what did you see in early 2015?
Well, I came to Baltimore from the emergency department, from the ER. And as an emergency physician, I have to say unequivocally that violence is a health issue. I've seen people come in as victims of violence. They're patients who are shot, they're stabbed. And we know, based on science, that violence is something that spreads from person to person. It's a contagious disease like other illnesses. There is a way to prevent it. There is a way to cure it. That's what I saw in Baltimore City, just like I saw in other parts of the country. And when I came to Baltimore, what struck me the most is one number, which is the number 20. You could have a child born today in one neighborhood in Baltimore who can expect to live a whole 20 years less than a child born in a neighborhood just a few miles away. 65 years compared to 85 years. Violence is a part of it, but then we also have to look at disparities that are literally everywhere. There is, you know, one of my staff members who lives in Baltimore and is a person in recovery from drug addiction said four words to me. He said, "Hurt people, hurt people." Which is the recognition that if we are to address the issues of violence, we also have to look at trauma. And trauma is related to mental health, to addiction, but it also is related to these deep disparities, these systemic disparities that we see everywhere in our city as well. And it's that 20-year life expectancy difference that we need to get at in order to really make a difference in any of the issues that we see, including violence as a public health issue.
You say it's like a disease, or you actually said it is a disease. So it behaves like a disease in a community? Is that what you're saying? It leads to lower life expectancy, clearly.
Studies have shown that violence is something that spreads like a contagious illness, that it spreads from person to person, that there is a way to prevent it, just like other diseases. There is a way to stop it. And there is a cycle that occurs as well, that individuals who are the victims of violence can also be the perpetrators. I remember seeing this patient in the ER, for example, who was 16 years old and came in with 3 gunshot wounds. He was shot once in the chest and twice in the abdomen. And we looked up his medical records at the time that we were resuscitating him, trying to find out if he had any other medical conditions. And it turned out that he had been in the ER just 2 months ago with another gunshot wound. And several months before that, he was there as the victim of a hand injury because he had punched someone. I mean, it's that cycle that we have to seek to interrupt. And there's also this cycle of violence and trauma that's also our duty to interrupt as physicians, as public health practitioners as well.
You're an advocate for seeing violence as a public health issue. Some listening may ask, how could it not be seen that way? What are the alternatives to seeing it as a public health issue? Perhaps the paradigms that you run up against that you have to say, no, here's the way to see it.
There are plenty of people who would say that violence is primarily a law enforcement and public safety issue, which I don't doubt that it is in some way. I mean, none of us can function in our silos. None of us can work alone. But we also know that, looking at my city in Baltimore in April of 2015, just a few months after I started in my job, we saw what happened when an unarmed African-American man named Freddie Gray died while in police custody, and the problems that resulted after that with the city breaking out in civil unrest and unearthing decades of structural racism and practices that have of policing that have led us to where we are. And so it's also changing this paradigm and saying, yes, public safety plays a role. Public safety, though, has to work hand in hand with public health.
When I look at your work in Baltimore, you describe so many different facets, so many different routes of violence that have to be tackled. How have you done it in just over 2 years? What have you concentrated on? Where have you found success in treating it as a public health issue?
We are using a 3-pronged approach to addressing violence as a public health issue. The first is to interrupt violence where it is occurring. So seeing every interaction as a point for intervention. We have a program, for example, called Safe Streets, where we hire individuals, who many of whom are former gang members or drug dealers. We hire them to walk the streets of the city, and they stop violence where they see it occurring. And in 1 year, just last year, our Safe Streets outreach workers interrupted 700 conflicts, the vast majority of which, over 80% of which, were deemed later to be likely or very likely to result in gun violence. So that's hundreds, potentially, of gunshot wounds and fatal shootings that were averted.
If you just joined us, we've been listening to Dr. Lena Wen, Health Commissioner for the City of Baltimore, just over 2 years, a guest at the University of Iowa in this special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's turn to some of our other panelists gathered at the Callahan Auditorium, the University of Iowa College of Public Health. Carletta Knox Seymour is with us as well. She's a Cedar Rapids businesswoman and also president of the board of Iowans for Gun Safety. Carletta, you're sitting next to Dr. Wen. When you hear the things that she's described going on in Baltimore, you have equal concerns. I think Cedar Rapids is something like a sixth the size of Baltimore. But Cedar Rapids, as I outlined at the beginning, has had problems of violence. Where did you step in to become actively involved in improving your community?
It started 4 years ago by way of running for city council at large. Didn't win, but I became very active in the community in tons of ways. Mm-hmm. Then 2 years ago, I ran again. Still didn't win, but I still got, I continued to be very involved.
What propelled you to run for office? Even though you say you didn't make it, was there a moment, was there an event that made you engaged?
Yes. Well, actually, for the last, for 6 years, I have been I was a city planning commissioner. Housing issues were problematic for a lot of neighbors. So that was kind of the beginning of how my worldview was getting shaped inside of Cedar Rapids, which I was born and raised in, moved away, been away for many years. But having come back, I began to see my city in a different way. I was also involved with Iowa Democratic Black Caucus, and it was then as well where myself and others that went around different cities within Iowa to find out what's going on in each of those communities, those cities where there were the larger black populations. Mm-hmm. In almost every city, the top five were the same top five issues in just about every city where black people live.
Which were?
Again, housing, police brutality in some form or another, unemployment, medical issues, those kinds of things. And of course, violence. I mean, there's always that. But I'm saying it was that those top five became the kind of the linchpin, if you will, in terms of everything that was happening in most black neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. You are a resident of Cedar Rapids, as you mentioned. For those listening who are not acquainted with Cedar Rapids, challenges in the area of violence in the last few years, 2014, 2015, particularly bad years. I think 2015, according to my research, the worst year for incidents of gunshots being fired. January of 2016, police responding to 14 of those episodes in just 1 month. We had in March a dozen of the incidents reported. And the city saw in March of 2016 the deadliest weekend of the year. And then in 2016, we saw the first drop of shots fired, these type of incidents happening. You've talked about sort of the root causes here, Carletta. Tie them into violence. Some may not understand, well, you're talking about housing. Mm-hmm. You're talking about this and that. Is that really gun violence? Is that violence you see on the street? What is the tie-in?
Absolutely. I always like to say, not because I like to say it, but this is the phrase that I have coined for many years, poverty is violent. Anytime anyone, whoever they may be, living in situations where their circumstance is where they have hardly any opportunity to grow, to prosper, to have upward mobility. If it's not there, if there's a lack of anything that would allow a person to move up, mm-hmm. then you're going to have problems. Because why? Because people are angry. We have people who are broken. We're talking broken people. So if they don't have the basics, listen, it's the old phrase where people say, you know, just tell them to pull themselves up by the bootstrap.
There you go.
Well, my goodness, you know, you have to have several things that make that boot. And if you don't have all the parts that make that boot, guess what? You're not going to be able to pull your boots up because you don't have the straps.
Okay, Carletta Knox Seymour with us. If you just joined us, listening to this special edition of River to River, a businesswoman in Cedar Rapids who got involved in the last few years to help her community in new ways. She's also president of the Board of Iowans for Gun Safety. Let's talk to some of our panelists. Corinne Peek Asa is with us, Associate Dean for the University of Iowa College for Research for the University of Iowa College of Public Health. Corinne, you've been listening to Dr. Wen. You've been listening to Carletta here. You oversee, you know, more than 60 research faculty and staff at the University of Iowa Injury Prevention Research Center. Give us your view. So we kind of zoom out from Cedar Rapids to Iowa as a whole, or the country as a whole. How you see what we're talking about here in a nutshell? What you're most interested in?
Well, one thing that resonated when Lena and Carlotta were both talking about the root causes, and one of the challenges we have and why we think it's a public health issue, is that many people think of violence as an individual event. And we, you know, sort of see it as serial events that happen to individuals. But in public health, we really want to take a much bigger lens and look at it as a societal issue. So individuals are nested within their families, which are nested within communities, nested within their social, cultural, political structures. And when you listened to Lena and Carlotta talk about the root causes, they really got down to issues that were societal. So another element of public health that we really focus on is the need to have evidence-informed decisions. And so we need research, but we also need people in communities and agencies to inform the research they need and help it do it in a way that we create evidence that can help move programs forward. Mm-hmm. So for example, if we look at the policy world, we've done some research evaluating state policies on bullying prevention, on sexual violence. We need a bigger evidence based on how do we move forward with gun safety and policies that help not remove guns, but help them be safer. I think that's where everyone knows the public debate is, but it's still one that's very hard to have. But a policy just in and of itself is not magic. There's a lot of stuff that's happened in order to get there. So, for example, before our state implemented a pretty comprehensive bullying prevention policy with schools, we had to understand that that was an issue. And so that required data. It required putting the data and the stories together. It required educating decision makers and then empowering them to realize there are policies you can put in place that really do fundamentally change the culture and the behavior in schools. So another piece of the policy approach is that, policies may trickle down to individuals. And with bullying prevention, what you ultimately want to do is reduce usually a child from bullying another child. But the changes usually happen at an agency level or a community level. And so again, we're not talking about an individual. We're talking about a much larger structure within our community. And so what we want to do in public health is bring community groups, stakeholders from agencies, lawmakers, schools, families together and have discussions about what our priorities are and how do we use an evidence base to move those forward.
Baltimore has been held up as a model in tackling these problems. I wonder, for you, Corinne, what do you look specifically to Baltimore and what Dr. Wen has been doing there that can apply here in Iowa, can be a remedy for some of the same types of problems we're having with violence here?
I think there are two secret ingredients, and the first one is engagement. So getting people all across the spectrum involved in the discussion. And that has to involve the community. It has to involve leaders in the community and policymakers. So no one of those groups can do it alone. And then the second is that there has to be evidence and information that helps move those decisions forward and to benchmark the activities as they go along the way. So I'm very happy that in the state, the Cedar Rapids released a report focused on violence prevention that involved a task force. It needs a lot more engagement, but it's a really good place to start. Des Moines is in the process of putting together a violence prevention plan that has involved a lot of stakeholders. So I see a lot of these pieces coming together in Iowa. And I think the other piece that Lena talked about in Baltimore is that they really helped the community help themselves, helped families help themselves. So as Carlotta said, we know that accumulated trauma that starts at childhood and then becomes intergenerational, that there's evidence of even epigenetic shifts that can be transferred from parent to child. We need to interrupt that. And it's not going to happen externally.
Corinne Peek-Asa is with us of the University of Iowa College of Public Health, where she's Associate Dean for Research. Let's hear from Benny LeHue, Coordinator for Injury and Violence Prevention at the Iowa Department of Public Health. Give us a statewide picture of where you see perhaps hot spots and things that you are focusing on at the Iowa Department of Public Health to tackle this problem. Benny?
Well, thank you, Ben. We are also taking that public health approach that's a very comprehensive approach because violence is a complex issue. We do that in some program areas because violence encompasses a lot of different types of violence, including suicide, self-directed violence, homicide, might be interpersonal, such as intimate partner violence or sexual violence. So some of our programs are funded to very specifically address those. But I would just say, to be consistent with what everyone else is saying, we look to the research to tell us what are those individual interventions that we can do with young families that can begin to either address the trauma or teach those parents how to parent healthy through nurse-family partnerships. What are some of those early education programs and programs that give kids skills that they can learn to stop, breathe, interrupt a violence or do conflict mediation. And then again, at the community level, what are the environmental changes that could be made? If it's a neighborhood or a community where there's a high density of alcohol outlets, what are the policies? What can be done to change those hours? What can we do to make the neighborhood safe so kids have a place to gather and play or a way to get to school safely? So those are some examples at all those different levels that we would be promoting through our community violence prevention programs.
Briefly, Benny, how far do we have to go in Iowa before what is being learned in Baltimore or in Cedar Rapids or Des Moines or in studies at the University of Iowa College of Public Health is adopted by policymakers, the people with the power? Do you see this really being treated as a public health issue?
I definitely do. And I think that what's going on in Cedar Rapids and now in Polk County are good examples of they invited public health to the table to say, help us convene the folks to learn what is this multi-level strategy. So it's starting. The other thing that is happening is we have 20 more or more years of research out there as to what is effective at preventing violence, and we're beginning to see that adopted in communities.
Mm-hmm. Corinne, you wanted to jump in there and respond.
I do think we have a misconception in Iowa that's holding us back. And that's when we talk about violence in Baltimore, we think drugs and gangs, and we think, oh, that's the city stuff, and we're not really city folks. But I think it's very important to first recognize that some of the highest homicide rates are in issues like intimate partner violence, in interpersonal relationships, and then in suicide, which Benny brought up. We have very high suicide rates, self-directed violence, that is violence. And so those rates are equal and sometimes even higher in rural and isolated rural areas than they are in cities. And then I think we cannot ignore the fact that we are pockets of little cities, sometimes very small cities, sometimes bigger ones, that we see in Council Bluffs and Dubuque and Cedar Rapids and Des Moines. And those don't have rates that look like inner city Los Angeles, but they have rates that we need to not be happy with. We should not be okay with anyone dying in a gang-related or drug-related death, nor should we be okay with a child that's abused or a partner who is in fear for their life with the person that lives with them. So I think we do need to recognize that this is not a city problem.
Coming up after a short break, our community conversation on violence in Iowa continues with our panelists, including Dr. Lena Wen, Health Commissioner for the City of Baltimore. As you've been hearing, she advocates addressing cities' issues with poverty, gun violence, and addiction as public health issues. Also on the panel, Carletta Knox-Seymour of Iowans for Gun Safety, Corinne Peek-Asa, the director of the University of Iowa Injury Prevention Research Center, and Benny LaHue of the Iowa Department of Public Health. Back with more of our conversation in just a moment.
If you just joined us, this is a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, coming to you from Callahan Auditorium at the University of Iowa College of Public Health, recorded on Tuesday, April 18th. It's a community conversation on violence in Iowa. And the guest of honor here, Dr. Lena Wen, Health Commissioner for the City of Baltimore, also an ER physician, and has really made Baltimore a model for how to combat violence of all types, how to get at the roots of what's feeding violence, that it's a much bigger picture than just criminal justice. just law enforcement is the message, I guess, from the panel we have today. Carletta Knox Seymour with us, Cedar Rapids resident, businesswoman, and also someone who's passionate about her community as president of the Board of Iowans for Gun Safety, and Benny LeHue of the Iowa Department of Public Health, as well as Corinne Peek-Asa of the University of Iowa College of Public Health, where she is director of the University of Iowa Injury Prevention Research Center. So let's talk a little bit more in this part of the program about how we get to those solutions. If we're learning in Baltimore, putting ideas to work, engaging the community, what are the roadblocks that we're encountering that you see need to be moved by people who can do it, people of power? And I want to talk about politics as well, because that's how things get done in our communities and in our country. Let me turn to you, Dr. Nguyen. What do you, in the 2 years that you've been in Baltimore, what roadblocks have you encountered there?
I'll answer this by telling you two stories that really changed my perspective and actually were very humbling experiences. The first is when I first came to the city. And there was a community meeting, and I came to specifically talk to our youth. These are kids between the ages of 8 and 13. And I asked these youth, what are the biggest issues that you see? And I wasn't trying to get at violence at all. I was just trying to get at what are the biggest health issues. And actually, the nickname for the Baltimore City Health Department is the Agency of Bugs, Drugs, and Sex. And so I thought that...
Bugs, drugs, and sex.
And so I thought, all right, I'm going to get some questions in this realm. But actually, one after the other, every single one of these kids, and these are 8, 9, 10-year-olds for the most part, they said one thing, which is mental health. They actually didn't say the words mental health.
What were they talking about then?
They were talking about trauma. They were talking about what it was like to wake up in the morning and go to school when nobody else woke up in the morning because everybody else takes prescription drugs and everybody else is addicted to drugs. Or they talked about poverty in a very similar way to what Carletta said, the trauma of growing up so poor that they won't have dinner that night. And they don't know whether they're going to have a roof over their head that night. And it's that deep trauma that they were expressing. And they also expressed to me the trauma of always being seen as a problem, that people always viewed black and brown children as a problem to deal with rather than as assets to be recruited. And it was a very humbling experience because these are not the issues that I was expecting from these kids, but I knew that that was something we had to address. So second part of it was when we actually started to address it, we thought that we had an opportunity post Freddie Gray, after the attention on Baltimore, to really focus on trauma. And actually there was a window of opportunity to address it in a way that may not have been present before. So we had an opportunity to apply for a federal grant, a very large federal grant, up to $5 million over 3 years. And it was a federal grant specifically for addressing trauma and developing resilience in communities post-unrest. I mean, we thought that Baltimore City had a very good chance of getting this large grant. And so my team and I came to another community meeting in West Baltimore in the areas heavily affected by the unrest, and we were very happy because we said, look, we have this opportunity. We're going to be able to bring resources to the city. We're going to implement these national best practices and send out teams and help the city. Mm-hmm. And we got one reaction, not what I had expected, because I thought people would say, this is great. We need the resources. Let's do it.
Yeah.
We heard, who are you? Who are you to come and tell us about our experiences of trauma, to define that for us? Okay, and who are you to bring these best practices from elsewhere? Maybe they work elsewhere. Maybe some of them came from rural communities. Maybe some of them are good and will apply to us. But maybe some of them were conceived of in the laboratory, and in, you know, not that I'm anti-science or research, but maybe it's not. Maybe we already have solutions in the community, and what we need your help with is not just to bring money in that we're never going to see. and that you're going to be implementing, but we're never going to see actually where this money goes. How do we know this is not just another program that actually will cause us more trauma at the end of the day?
And that stopped you in your tracks and made you rethink?
It was again, a very humbling experience. I mean, it was hard to hear because this is not our intention, right? We don't want to be coming to our community and re-traumatizing them by giving them, of all things, a grant on trauma. But we decided actually that this was an opportunity for us to try something very different, which is that even though this is a federal grant and the money would be coming to the city because that's how the allocation is going to be done, that we applied for this grant with $3 million of the $5 million completely unallocated. And we specifically said that we're going to have a community board elected by the community who are going to decide how those funds are going to be used. I mean, it's a little bit scary to be doing that because we're still the people who are responsible for distribution of these funds. And at the end of the day, it's our problem if the funds are not used the right way. But we think this is an opportunity for us to finally listen, right, mm-hmm. to engage, to use the evidence, but also to lift up the community in the way that they had requested and not just in the way that we think the community should be.
And their reaction being engaged this way rather than the outside money coming into a certain group of people, did the community react to your adjustment there?
I mean, to be honest, it's still a work in progress. We received the grant in October, so about 6 months ago now. It's still a work in progress because there is a lot of skepticism. I mean, our community is pretty sick of people coming in, swooping in when there are cameras around, giving resources when the national media pays attention and when there are talking heads speaking about the problems. I mean, everybody comes to our city. Mm-hmm. But then when the media attention disappears, so does the funding. And so I think people are skeptical that, well, follow through. And it's one of these things that only time and our actions will prove our intentions.
Carletta, you as a Cedar Rapids resident, you're sitting next to Dr. Nguyen and nodding your head vigorously at times when we talk about trauma, we talk about minorities being seen as a problem rather than opportunities. What resonates with you about what Dr. Nguyen is saying right now?
Yeah, what started resonating was things that she began with, which were actually your question, what have been some of the blocks? We began to understand that this, what we're facing in Cedar Rapids is a public health issue. I wrote an op-ed that was in the paper regarding that in terms of why we believe that bringing in the CDC was the right thing to do. The resistance that we got was
resistance
major.
From where?
From city council, from, they just weren't ready to jump on board to say, and I'm going to kind of piggyback on Dr. Nguyen right now, to say that, who are you to think that you have answers or you could even come up with how we can tackle this problem in Cedar Rapids? I mean, the people that live in those areas, the communities where we have the major areas of violence, it is important that we interact with them, that we get their listen, they live it every day.
Before we end this hour, make sure we get to the politics of this. This whole topic is perhaps as no other issue, there are a few other issues, nestled in a thorny bed of politics, violence, gun violence especially. Let me just throw this out and answer whoever would like. How have politics been a challenge in this context? Dr. Nguyen, when you talk about the experience in Baltimore, where do politics enter the picture and how have they presented a challenge, national politics or the politics of Maryland?
Politics of Maryland and Baltimore City are not the challenge. We have a progressive city, a progressive state, and I don't think there's much disagreement around the core issue that violence is a public health issue. There may be disagreements about how we're going to address it or what funding is going to be allocated to it, but the principle of it is not up to debate in our area, which I'm very thankful for. I will say that the national politics has an influence. I mean, I'm not trying to make this a partisan conversation, but this is just a factual conversation that there is by the very nature of gun violence and guns being so politicized, there is a political element to it. And I worry about federal funding for a lot of our programs. Mm-hmm. And we still have a situation where federal funding does not even cover gun violence research.
Let's go to our audience here. We have a woman here with a couple questions. Yes,
okay.
Go ahead.
My name is Linda Topinka, and I'm from Cedar Rapids. I'm a part of One Strong, and I'm also a clinical social worker. Does anyone see how adverse childhood experiences is connected to the violence? And that's the public health. They have already identified adverse childhood experiences as a public health issue. So I guess I'm having some trouble with why everybody's having so much trouble getting on board with that.
Mm-hmm. Corinne, can you tackle that
sure.
one?
Well, just for audience members who maybe aren't familiar, there is a growing body of research that shows that adverse childhood experiences, which is any experience that is so persistently traumatic to the developing child that it derails their development, has not only very severe lifelong consequences for health, which include a premature death, a higher likelihood of dying prematurely from every single one of the leading causes
exactly,
of death.
Exactly.
And those include things like child abuse, but it also includes being raised in a very chaotic household, having a household member with a substance abuse issue, a mental health issue that portrays a way that affects the child's development. Certainly not every mental health situation is one that causes trauma, but some of them do. Having a caregiver
poverty.
Incarcerated. So there, it can be whatever is traumatic to the child. And so many of those are violent experiences directly. But I think that we need to think as a society about the very profound effects that has on us as a societal level. We still think about it as, oh, that child had an adverse experience or that adult is acting that way because of their trauma history. And we need to address that and have services that are, you know, what we call trauma-informed care so that someone's behavior and what has brought them to that point is part of how the resources are provided to help them come above it. But we need to move so upstream to think about preventing them.
Mm-hmm.
And, when we talk about the physical, the diabetes, the heart disease, how that plays a part in that. So when you talk about evidence-based, there's already so much evidence already there.
And you're saying, why hasn't it been acted on better?
Yeah, definitely, that's what I'm saying. I'm talking about that.
Could I just answer? Okay. There actually is a lot happening. It's taken a while, but I've been pleased that over the last few years, through at the state in Des Moines, we have several departments: Department of Justice, Attorney General's Office, Human Services, Corrections, Education, Public Health, who've been coming together to say, now that we know what we know, how do we use this understanding to change how we deal with people in corrections? And so there's beginning to be attempts in that direction.
And I want to address this. In the notion of stigma, because we can't ignore the irony of Lena talking about going to the community and not being trusted so they can't move forward. And then Carlotta saying, well, we are the community. We went to the city and we couldn't move forward because they didn't trust us. And so, you know, when we think about cancer, and so if you have survived cancer, you're a cancer survivor and you're part of a group that has a lot of clout, but from advocacy, from empowerment. But if you're the victim of violence, you are a stigma to the society. And we need to get beyond that. So that we empower more champions, because the key to Baltimore getting beyond where they were, the key to Cedar Rapids getting beyond their exactly opposite issue, is that someone is so passionate they are not going to give up. And we need more voices with that passion who have the experience, who've lived the experience, to be heard. And so we have the data. There is incontrovertible evidence about the social gain of investing in violence prevention, but we haven't yet empowered enough stories to really tip the energy level.
Okay. In the interest of time, let's move to another question from our audience here at Callahan Auditorium at the University of Iowa College of Public Health. Our panelists, if you just joined us, Carlotta Knox Seymour, Corinne Peek-Asa, Benny LeHue, and Dr. Lena Wen, winding up our hour here. Yes, sir. Thank you for waiting.
I'm from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and I'm a member of One Strong. And prior to One Strong asking the city council to treat violence as a public health problem and to invite the CDC and the Cedar Rapids, no organization in the city had approached it that way. And there was resistance. But getting to the question, how, and this is the issue across the board in Cedar Rapids and throughout this country, how do we convince the large community, and particularly policymakers, that black lives are worth anything? And thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir. Any reaction to what this gentleman from Cedar Rapids said there? Corinne.
Well, it's very clear that violence disproportionately affects disadvantaged communities based on economics, but also based on race. However, it is not true that when we've seen rates rise in white communities, we've done more about it. We haven't. It has not mattered that white kids will kill white kids, men kill women, men kill men. It has not mattered who's killing whom. We still have not addressed this as a social issue. So, you know, I'm going to say something about politics, not about our current political climate. But when you ask politicians, what is it that makes you, you know, take on an issue? They are the beasts of their constituents. And when you ask them who they're hearing from, they're hearing more from the way they vote. So again, it's this notion of empowerment. And we need more voices. We need to empower the champions to speak out and be heard. That's how, for example, you know, cancer has gotten so much money. There are so many people who are speaking in favor of that. But I also think resources are important, but they're not the only thing. We can solve a lot of these problems through innovation by working together. And I think the challenge again there is reducing the stigma and empowering community champions and as all the way up through legislative stakeholder champions. I also don't think legislation, like, you know, we can't prison our way out of this. We can't legislate our way out of it. Those are key pieces. But a lot of the really innovative government is going on locally, not even at the federal level or the state level. So it's the city health commissioners and the community leaders that are driving what's really innovative right now.
Dr. Nguyen, what is your view on how racism fits into this discussion here, and also the experience that you've had in Baltimore?
I think the gentleman who asked the question is exactly right. It's something that I think about a lot of, you know, there have been people in Baltimore City dying from the opioid epidemic, from the crack epidemic for decades. The numbers were high 20 years ago. The numbers are high now. And suddenly, it seems, overdose and addiction are public health emergencies. They are public health emergencies, but they were public health emergencies 20 years ago. Why is it that we had to wait for white people in the suburbs and rural areas to start dying, that we said, okay, maybe it's not a moral failing? Part of it is the recognition, part of the answer to how we can get to a better place is the recognition that we have to be honest with ourselves and that we have not, for generations, been willing to have these conversations.
Let's sort of wrap this up, tie any loose ends together that you'd like. Dr. Nguyen, if we would come here together in 5 or 10 years again, what would you hope the discussion, how would it have moved along?
Sometimes there's a tendency after listening to conversations like this to say, wow, these problems are so big. If it's not about the individual, it's about society. And it's not just about one issue of violence, but it's also about poverty and all these other things.
It's overwhelming.
Where do we, yeah, exactly. Where do we even start?
Right.
I hope that we'll transition from that mindset of, oh, wow, this is just too much, to what is it that we can each do today? Maybe what we can each do today is to change the mindsets of people around us, to start speaking up about our own experiences. Maybe it's about, for some of us, it's about doing research on the issue. Maybe it's getting involved in local nonprofits. Maybe it's speaking to our legislators. But there is something that we can each do. I very much agree that the solutions are not going to come from top down. They're going to involve lifting up what's working in communities, lifting up what's working by our community leaders, faith leaders, neighborhood associations, maybe cities and towns and local jurisdictions can be the laboratories to develop those tools that can then be replicated elsewhere.
You jump down to Benny LeHue. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts as we wrap up this discussion?
I'm finding myself agreeing exactly with what she's saying. And I think about this every day in our work because of the stories we hear and the importance of what one person can do in their own lives. It's ironic because I came here with a colleague and we were talking about she'll be beginning a series of listening sessions in some communities across the state to hear from people, what do you see is needed to prevent sexual violence? And I think that's very important that we don't stop listening and bringing more people to the table, and that we all, in this period where I've seen a lot of activism come out among my peers, my friends, my family, I can do something on my street. We can do something, and we all have a role to play. That would be my message.
Corinne Peek-Asa?
I've been in this field for a very long time. And I remember when maybe a handful of states even had a violence prevention coordinator like what we have at the Iowa Department of Public Health.
So you can see the progress already.
Yeah. And, you know, when you start change, it's messy and it's uncomfortable. And so I think we're at that point that we're uncomfortable with this conversation, but we're having it. And I see that as such a huge step forward. I think we are... You know, I see public health leaders, I see community leaders on our panel, in our audience. So we have the champions. We have come so far that we should be happy to be at this uncomfortable spot. You know, but the next steps will not be as hard. We just can't lose the momentum that we have to get us here.
You're making notes. What would you like to leave us with in thoughts?
I'm really pushing for black people to, I just want them to become more engaged in a really strong way to get out there and make their concerns known, but collectively, not just be one single voice, but collectively.
All right. Great discussion. Let's thank our panelists. And that ends this Community Conversation on Violence in Iowa, a special edition of our program recorded on Tuesday, April 18th at the University of Iowa College of Public Health. We want to thank Dan McMillan and the University of Iowa College of Public Health for their invitation to partner on this program. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.